Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And as we kind of push forward, we'll dive right into the debates. But fortunately, we actually have Paul Venable with us. And so, hey, Paul, welcome back. I really missed you. It really helps to kind of go through this and have a discourse with somebody, because that way, if there's any questions in your mind, you might actually help convey what other people might be thinking. So anyway, I really appreciate your assistance on this.
Well, thanks. And I usually always have questions, so looking forward to it.
All right. So we kind of covered 2 days of ratification debates. Anything piquing your interest or anything that you're just, you know, foaming at the mouth that you want to, you know, bring up, or saved rounds, as I call them? So,
well, I was in the car as I was listening to your show yesterday, and you ended on the religious test, which I think is kind of really important to consider. The question has come up even in the last few years, and I think where we're going here is that that is addressed by the oath. I think that's where we're going.
Yes. Well, so it's that plus, you know, in Madison's remonstrance on religion, which actually was a predecessor or predated the Constitution. He did that in 1787 or 1786, right before the Constitutional Convention. And he was really, really clear that, you know, it is just repugnant in trying to create a theocracy in America, because there were too many different faiths, too many different religions. And, you know, what that would do is, because theocracy got established in Europe, and as theocracies, the good thing about the Roman Catholic Church was the fact that it had a uniform application of religion in its theocracy in governing the people. Now, the bad thing about it was, as we know, it wasn't necessarily aligned with the scriptures. It was very despotic. You know, the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, there was zero tolerance. And what ended up rising up, because when you regardless of how you form government, there's always going to be despots and demagogues that, you know, rise up to become tyrants. And so the framers were trying to create a system that wouldn't allow that. And they recognized that tyrants easily come from religion, because look at how many people died in the religious wars of Europe.
Sure.
So they needed to have something that was non-denominational. Now, the word that we hear in academia and today is secular. However, the definition of secular today is godless. And in their day, secular was not godless at all. Secular was non-denominational Christian. In other words, they were very careful about, you know, trying to institute any type of doctrine. As a matter of fact, when Madison was president, there were several times, because we had the War of 1812, and there were other issues that really caused problems, you know, some of the issues of New Orleans, and, you know, it becoming a state and so forth, that actually created, you know, it created a circumstance where Madison made an appeal to the American people that they would take fast and remembrance or fast and prayer, you know, in trying to, you know, unite the people or do certain things. And many of those, like he didn't retract the one for going into war, but many of those, after he did it, he goes, you know what, I think I might be, you know, utilizing my position to invoking religious worship, and I shouldn't do that. So after he did these things, he retracted those and said, you know, it's just a suggestion for people. I'm not actually calling for a national day of fast and prayer. And so
I am not. Is that what he said? I am not actually calling.
He retracted his call for a national day of fast and prayer. And he basically said, you know, the nation could benefit from individuals, but I am not, as the president, asking for you to take this day. I'm just asking that you are, I'm not as a president setting aside the day to do that, but we, you know, if you feel compelled to do that, that's something that can help. It's something like that. I mean, when you read these things, you know, he had to kind of, and in Madison's way, he was very, very good at trying to be, I don't want to use the word politically correct, but he was just accurate. And, you know, he kind of put it out with the way it was. And so he found himself, you know, overreacting on his religious faith as the president, and felt that a few of the times that he called for national fast and prayer was inappropriate, as he thought about it and said, no, this should be, you know, just a consideration for those, for the citizens of America. They may want to consider setting aside a day to do that instead of having a national day of doing it. Anyway, so as we look today, there are several theocratic groups out there. And I mean, you know, some of them are calling them extreme conservatives, but, you know, they refer to constitutionalists as extreme conservatives. And I take umbrage with the fact that we're lumped into that group, because the constitutionalists do not have, you know, a religious. Not that we're not religious, we just don't have this hardcore, we're reestablishing a Christian government.
Okay.
Your thoughts?
I'm right with you. I think it's, what happens, I have friends who are not, you know, you mentioned earlier that we need every fist in this fight. I know people who are willing to get in this foxhole with me who are not only, you know, not Christians, they're avowed non-Christians. I've got friends who are, you know, who call themselves anarcho-capitalists or even atheists. And the interesting thing about these people is they recognize that they're in this mess also, and they want to do something about it. This one guy, and if he's listening, buddy, you know who you are, all right? He is probably, I would consider him a better Christian than some people who wear the moniker, just because of the way he helps and cares about people.
Right.
He's just experienced, you know, his past life experience has pushed him away from God, but not away from a mindset in which he wants to help people and he wants to do what's right. And, you know, frankly, he's not far from a Christian himself, but he'll never admit that. The point is that we just can't turn people away when we need everyone to stand up at this particular time. I think that we're facing perils that rival the days of the dawn of the Republic.
Yeah, so here's something that I think is a miss that people really don't understand. There are religious faiths that are compatible with liberty, individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our form of government. And there are faiths that are incompatible. And so people look at, oh, this freedom of religion means Satanism is something that can be, you know, practiced in America. Luciferianism, what have you. And I'm actually here to tell you that that type of faith is incompatible with individual liberty, because Satanism is not about giving people liberty. It is about subjugation and enslavement. Satanism in its true form comes forth in communism or Mohammedism, where compulsion is used and your liberty of, you know, following and your conscience and developing a, you know, your own relationship and your own religious expression with Christ. And so many people, and the reason I'm going down this, you know, taking this little turn for just a quick second, is the fact that many people look at, and actually the Satanists, the atheists, have kind of invoked. I mean, it's one thing to be an atheist, to be truly secular, you know, and not try to, you know, espouse their religious faiths upon others. I mean, it's one thing for somebody to go down that path and say, I'm an atheist. I'm a religious, I'm not there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's another thing when they actually say, you can't have your religion, because once they take that turn, and once they say you can't in public, you know, express yourselves, you can't do these things, and then they actually, if, by using our tolerance of allowing them to be, they start. It's the camel's nose in the tent, where all of a sudden they start injecting themselves, and next thing you know, they take over the tent, and next thing you know, everybody's out of the tent because they've commandeered it. And mm-hmm. It is incompatible to basically inflict that and take away the religious rights of others. Now, you may be offended, you know, and it's one thing if, you know, a school, and this is why I really going down a rat hole here. This is why I honestly think had the framers maintained a relationship with churches when they went non-denominational, but instead of having the state-sponsored church, they'd kind of scaled that back, and they'd actually, you know, based on apportionment, in other words, dividing it up based on, you know, how many Baptists you have, how many Lutherans you have, how many different faiths you have, and then saying, okay, well, this is the amount of money we're going to share, and then, you know, make sure that these are congregationally supported churches. In other words, you know, if you have an atheist church that doesn't believe in tithing, doesn't believe that you people need to sacrifice and those types of things, like Soros throws a whole bunch of money in, and we're you know, and the whole point of creating an atheist church is actually to compete with Christianity, because it has nothing to do with actually trying to be a compassionate body for the people. In other words, trying to create a true church in providing temporal welfare for, you know, the welfare, healthcare, education, those types of things for the people. It is a vice or a tool that atheists use to actually get government to actually use compulsion. And this is how we got to where we were. This is a part of Satan's plan. And so anyway, I just see that had they actually maintained a symbiotic relationship with the churches in the community, and instead of going hardcore secular from non-denominational into godlessness, then we sure. would have avoided, you know, this whole Antichrist church being formed by the federal government.
Mm-hmm. I can see that.
Because the states would have still maintained, you know, this cognizance and awareness of the role Christianity, or not even just Christianity, the role good faiths actually provide for the people. Because I look at other faiths, Judaism, I look at Hinduism and those types of faiths, and they actually are, you know, they're not incompatible with our Constitution.
Well, you said something about providing for the people, and I think they attempt to do that.
Yes, they do. But they don't use compulsion. In other words, they don't go around mm-hmm. and get people on board and then basically coerce them, and or, you know, I mean, Mohammedans, they live under the threat of death all the time. You know, either you do this, or if you go away. Go ahead.
Assimilate or die.
Assimilate or die, or if you convert to another faith, die. In other words, you must maintain, you know, this worship of Allah. And if not, the consequence is death. I mean, you become an apostate, you're dead. I mean, that is not a religion of liberty. Nor is communism. Now, communism in a free world seems to be, you know, um, I'll just I'll just make this appearance to have liberty, because you can freely go into communism, come out. But once communism seeks control and has control, it's over. There's no way communism will allow any form of religions or those types of things that would be contrary to what they're imposing on people. They're completely intolerant. There's no tolerance in those systems.
Anyway. It is a kind of religion in itself, but in a
it is
bizarre kind of way.
No, as a matter of fact, Engels and Marx were very clear that they needed to take control of babies, you know, and make sure that the babies were grown up under the, you know, the cognizance of the state, and that they would make all the decisions, you know, of, you know, where you go, what career you have, and those types of things. It's literally Plato's Republic, you know, actualized, to where the state determined everything and the state was in full control. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so we're still in the Massachusetts debates, and I don't think we're going to get finished today because there's still a lot of other things here. But we're continuing on with religious comments, and actually Mr. Payson is where we left off, and I think this is like towards the end of January, right before February, because what's coming up is February 1st on Friday. Not sure if they met on January 31st. I'd have to look up the date here. Let me see. The last date that they had here was January 30th. So Wednesday, January 30th, apparently they didn't have January 31st in 1788.
You mean they didn't meet that day, or they didn't have it?
Well, so actually they didn't meet on the Thursday. So there was something that happened, either a weather event or what have you, because there's no records of the January 31st. So January 31st would have been a Thursday. The 30th was a Wednesday, and the 1st of February was a Friday. So we're on Wednesday, January 30th with Mr. Payson. And it starts, and this is about religion, and it starts talking about religion being, you know, the supreme object and so forth. So if you wouldn't mind taking it up from there.
Sure. The great object of religion being God supreme, and the seat of religion in man being the heart of the heart or conscience, i.e. the reason God has given us, employed on our moral actions in their most important consequences as related to the tribunal of God. Hence, I infer that God alone is the God of the conscience, and consequently attempts to erect human tribunals for the consciences of men are impious encroachments upon the prerogatives of God. Upon these principles, had there been a religious test as a qualification for office, it would, in my opinion, have been a great blemish upon the instrument.
There you go. Okay, so obviously these men are starting to realize that, you know, it may work, their religious state may work, but it technically, I think they're starting to realize that these religious or these theocracies, because John Adams made a plea in the Massachusetts Convention of 1801, when they were considering rewriting their constitution, he pleaded to them to allow the Jews to openly practice, and they didn't allow it. They did not amend.
Just a minute.
Go ahead.
Hang on. I'm sorry. What do you mean he pleaded with them for the Jews to openly practice? Was there something?
The Constitution
wrong?
Of Massachusetts did not allow other faiths to openly practice in Massachusetts.
Okay, so it wasn't just the Jews. It was just they had allied themselves with a particular faith and no other faith.
Correct.
Were allowed. Is that right?
But okay. Right, but he basically said, well, you know, because everybody else were infidels or heathens, and he made the plea, or he appealed to the people in pleading that they would at least allow the Jews to openly practice because they were living among them.
Right. Okay.
That they didn't allow Jews to openly practice in Massachusetts until 1833.
So now 1833.
Over 50 years of the under the revolution and so forth, right?
Okay, so here's a follow-up question.
Yeah, almost 50 years of the Republic, almost.
All right, so Massachusetts had a state church.
Yep.
And then they ad- maybe they didn't change that, but they admitted Jews in 1833. They allowed them to practice, even though they didn't allow others to practice.
Well, so I
or did they open it up to everybody?
You know, I actually have a document that lays out when the, because this is a good question, that lays out when did the states actually relinquish, in other words, no longer take tax dollars out of the public fund and giving it to the state church. And so let me see here. Where is that? Is religion. I'll have to look it up. When we go into break, I'll spend the time and look that up, because it actually documents when Massachusetts broke its tax ties or the funding ties away from the church, the Puritan church.
And before we get away from the subject, remember that there is here today a lot about this thing called the separation of church and state. But back then, the states had their own sponsored churches, which it sounds like, if I hear you correctly, they gave money to. They actually involved them, and I would imagine it was for the social needs of the people.
Yes, so the school systems, such as the higher education, the colleges, and those types of things, like in Massachusetts, Harvard was a religious institution, and actually Harvard's logo had three books facing upwards, as if facing upwards to heaven. The three books, I believe, was the Trinity. I mean, they were very religious, and so the primary schools. Yes, so it was 1833, and it wasn't just to allow the Jews. It was basically to sever the ties. It was 1833, the ties of the state funding a state-sponsored church and allowing everybody to, you know, practice. See, what they could have done is, instead of saying we're just going to give all this money to this church, you know, we realize that there's, you know, these different churches, and, you know, there's no reason why you can't form your own schools. And instead of migrating everything to a public school, they could have just allowed the churches to continue to do that. And, you know, if you could come in and you can create a congregation that was significant enough to merit a percentage out of the pie, to where, and when I say congregation, I mean people actually contributing. In other words, that church is self-funded. It's not, you know, being, you know, there's not a philanthropist actually, you know, providing that church for people.
Okay. But I think the point that I want to make is there was a constitutional argument in which people fought the relationship between church and state. It sounds like it just migrated away. Because that they tried to make that constitutional argument today, and, you know, even I object, and have objected to giving, you know, government money to churches.
Right.
However, in that day, in that time, they recognized something different. Okay, and it wasn't a constitution. It was 50 years after the revolution in 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like they simply migrated away. In other words, it wasn't a fight in Congress. It wasn't a fight about the Constitution. It was something that had been done for years, and they just kind of migrated away from it.
Well, so people So I think that migration was – the hearts and the minds actually started changing, and less people, you know, thought it was okay to keep others from being able to openly practice their religion. And the concept that, you know, we're actually denying people a fundamental right, you know, became kind of repugnant to them. And so, you know, because it only takes one really good zealot, and we're just now hitting the break, believe it or not. We've only got one little passage done. When you look at religion, it only takes one really hardcore zealot to actually become so tyrannical or so cruel that it actually turns the hearts and minds of the people and say, that's just wrong. But, you know, it was you're right. It was an evolutionary process to where people felt that they needed to do this. We'll be right back after this.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
This is my final comment on this. I think that a nation and a state and a land or area, whatever you're living in, community, is far better served to have one where liberty, individual liberty and individual sovereignty is one respected and actually protected, to where a person could actually, as long as what you're doing is not obscene and or offensive. And I'm telling you, Satanism will go very quickly to obscene and offensive for the mores of society and so forth, where it becomes literally dangerous and harmful, you know, exposing children to all sorts of, you know, evil things and so forth. So I believe that the community and a state has a right to have these protections to protect its culture and its mores, to not allow certain, but to actually go to, you know, to the point of, you know, everything is open and free. That's where you let the enemy come in. You have to have some kind of guarded standards to say, you know, if your faith, you know, supports these things and supports, you know, these mores, then okay. But if you cross these lines, then sorry, that's not a religion that is compatible with a state of liberty, because liberty isn't just freedom. Liberty is being responsible and accountable to the laws of the land and ensuring that, you know, we're, you know, enlightening society and bringing society to higher levels of its capacity, being able to perform to its optimum capacity. And Satanism is not one of those things that allows that. It is a debaser. It actually takes away our productivity and so forth. It consumes people with different addictions and so forth. So anyway, any parting thought or before we?
Nope.
Okay. So
I think we've covered it.
All right. So the next one, and this continues on, by the way, these conversations regarding the religious freedoms and so forth. But the next one is by General Heath. And this is actually the next comment to what this gentleman just said, as far as the blemish on the state constitution and or on the United States Constitution, having these mandates of religious tests and so forth.
Okay, so General Heath. Mr. President, after a long and painful investigation of the federal constitution by paragraphs, this honorable convention are drawing nigh to the ultimate question, a question as monumentous as ever invited the attention of man. We are soon to decide on a system of government digested not for the people of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts only, not for the present people of the United States only, but in addition to these, for all those states in which may hereafter rise into existence within the jurisdiction of the United States, and for millions of people yet unborn, a system of government not for a nation of slaves, but for a people as free and virtuous as any on earth, not for a conquered nation subdued to our will, but for a people who have fought, who have bled, and who have conquered, who under the smiles of heaven have established their independence and sovereignty, and have taken equal rank among the nations of the earth. In short, sir, it is a system of government for ourselves and for our children, for all that is near and dear to us in life. And on the decision of the question, is suspended our political prosperity or infelicity, perhaps our existence as a nation? What can be more solemn? What can be more interesting? Everything depends on our union. I know that some have supposed that, although the union should be broken, particular states may retain their importance, but this cannot be. The strongest nerved state, even the right arm, if separated from the body, must wither. If the great union be broken, our country as the nation perishes. And if our country so perishes, it will be as impossible to save a particular state as to preserve one of the fingers of a mortified hand. By one of the paragraphs of the system, it is declared that the ratifications of the conventions of nine states shall be sufficient for the establishment of the Constitution between states so ratifying the same. But, sir, how happy will it be if not only nine, but even all the states should ratify it? It will be a happy circumstance if only a small majority of this convention should ratify the federal system, but how much more happy if we could be unanimous. It will be a happy circumstance if a majority of the people of this commonwealth should be in favor of the federal system, but how much more so if they should be unanimous. And if there are any means whereby they may be united, every exertion should be made to effect it.
So that was a nice little, you know, speech in helping people kind of realize that we're coming to the end of this. And, you know, we're looking at a system that is definitely different. And how great would it be if we were all unanimous on ratifying? In other words, it's kind of like, you know, for a general, he's gathering the troops and lifting up their spirits to basically, you know, prepare themselves to, you know, move forward, and not necessarily move forward into battle, but move forward, you know, into a greater position. So now we move on to the president of, because let me see here. So the next person up is actually John Hancock. And this is where John Hancock actually stands up and says what he says. And as a matter of fact, I won't even give the picture here. Go ahead and just start off with the recommending of amendments.
All right. So the president, John Hancock, recommending amendments. The president, John Hancock, rose and observed that he was conscious of the impropriety, situated as he was, of his entering into the deliberations of the convention, that unfortunately, through painful indisposition of body, he had been prevented from giving his attendance in his place. But from the information he had received and from the papers, there appeared to him to be a great dissimilarity of sentiments in the convention. To remove the objections of some gentlemen, he felt himself induced, he said, to hazard a proposition for their consideration, which, with the permission of the convention, he would offer in the afternoon. So now we're going to the afternoon.
Right. So what that was kind of just this basic summary of, you know, what he basically said in the afternoon. If it be, you know, if it's okay with you, I would like to, you know, say a few things. And now we go to the afternoon, and this is what he said.
All right. When the convention met in the afternoon, His Excellency the President observed that, and they're speaking of Hancock, a motion had been made and seconded that this convention do assent to and ratify the Constitution, which had been under consideration, and that he had in the former part of the day intimated his intention of submitting a proposition to the convention. My motive, says he, arises from my earnest desire to this convention, my fellow citizens, and the public at large, that this convention may adopt such a form of government as may extend its good influence to every part of the United States and advance the prosperity of the whole world. His situation, His Excellency said, had not permitted him to enter into the debates of this convention. It, however, appeared to him necessary, from what had been advanced in them, to adopt the form of government proposed. But observing a diversity of sentiment in the gentlemen of the convention, he had frequently had conversation with them on the subject. And from this conversation, he was induced to propose to them whether the introduction of some general amendments would not be attended with the happiest consequences. For that he should, with the leave of the Honorable Convention, submit to their consideration a proposition in order to remove the doubts and quiet the apprehensions of gentlemen. And if, in any degree, the object should be acquired, he should feel himself perfectly satisfied. He should therefore submit them, for he was, he said, unable to go more largely into the subject if his abilities would permit him, relying on the candor of the convention to bear him witness that his wishes for a good constitution were sincere. His Excellency then read his proposition. This gentleman concluded, His Excellency, is the proposition which I had to make, and I submit it to your consideration with the sincere wish that it may have a tendency to promote a spirit of union.
Okay, so obviously they're kind of encapsulating what he said. And so what he's saying isn't necessarily relevant to defining a specific clause in the Constitution. What he is saying is kind of like what the General Heath had said before him. You know, I really want to see this Constitution passed, and if it would help, let's submit recommendations for amendments along with our ratification. And so go ahead, because the next person that speaks right after him is Samuel Adams.
Okay, this is Samuel Adams.
Yes.
All right. Mr. President, I feel myself happy in contemplating the idea that many benefits will result from Your Excellency's conciliatory proposition to this Commonwealth and to the United States, and I think it ought to proceed, the motion made by the gentleman from Newburyport, and to be at this time considered by the convention. I have said that I have had my doubts about this doubts of this Constitution. I could not digest every part of it as readily as some gentlemen, but this, sir, is my misfortune, not my fault. Other gentlemen have had their doubts, but in my opinion, the proposition submitted will have a tendency to remove such doubts and to conciliate the minds of the convention. And the people without doors, this subject, sir, is of the greatest magnitude and has employed the attention of every rational man in the United States. But the minds of the people are not so well agreed on it as all of us could wish. A proposal of this sort, coming from Massachusetts, from her importance, will have its weight. 4 or 5 states have considered and ratified the Constitution as it stands. But we know there is a diversity of opinion even in these states, and one of them is greatly agitated. If this convention should particularize the amendments necessary to be proposed, it appears to me it must have weight in other states where conventions have not yet met. I have observed the sentiments of a gentleman on the subject as far as Virginia, and I have found that the objections were similar in the newspapers and in some of the conventions. Considering these circumstances, it appears to me that such a measure will have the most salutary effect throughout the Union. It is of the greatest importance that America should still be united in sentiment. I think I have not heretofore been unmindful of the advantage of such a union. It is essential that the people should be united in the federal government to withstand the common enemy and to preserve their valuable rights and liberties. We find in the great state of Pennsylvania, 1/3 of the convention are opposed to it. Should then there be large minorities in the several states, I should fear the consequences of such disunion. Sir, there are many parts of it I esteem as highly valuable, particularly the article which empowers Congress to regulate commerce, to form treaties, etc. For want of this power in our national head, our friends have grieved and our enemies insult us. Our ambassador at the Court of London is considered as a mere cipher instead of a representative of the United States. Therefore, it appears to me that a power to remedy this evil should be given to Congress and the remedy applied as soon as possible.
Okay, so skipping down to the next day, or actually to Friday the 1st, we have now up again speaking Mr. Samuel Adams. So Adams just said that. And by the way, when we get done with all of this, I at the very bottom, I kind of put in some added notes And I highlight that so that you people will know if they read this that these are inserted by me. But what it does is I really break down, you know, how the Constitution was ratified in Massachusetts. So we'll get to that when that time comes. But anyway, again, Adams was against the Constitution until Hancock made this recommendation. He said, now there are certain things that I really like, especially, you know, our international relations regarding the regulation of commerce, treaties and trade and those types of things. He wasn't talking about regulating commerce within the state. He was really talking about the foreign regulation of commerce and standardizing and forcing the states to actually, you know, not be able to go outside the federal government to create their own treaties, that the federal government would have the ability to come down and spank them for doing those things. So anyway.
Well, it was also important to him because the United States had been free of Britain for over a decade, but they still weren't being treated with the respect of a sovereign state. Of a nation.
Right. And well, there was that, plus Britain was capturing ships and impressing the sailors and the Marines. I mean, Britain wasn't really honoring the treaty. They just considered us, you know, a parasite or a parasitical government that they still had to deal with.
Right. Okay. Okay. So again, we're back to the Honorable Mr. And I guess this is Sam Adams.
Yes, it is.
Or Samuel Adams. Mm-hmm. As Your Excellency was pleased yesterday to offer for the consideration of this convention certain propositions intended to accompany the ratification of the Constitution before us, I did myself the honor to bring them forward by a regular motion, not only from the respect due to Your Excellency, but from a clear conviction in my own mind that they would tend to affect the salutary and important purposes which you had in view, quote, the removing the fears and quieting the apprehensions of many of the good people of this commonwealth, and more effectually guarding against an undue administration of the federal government, end quote. I beg leave, sir, more particularly to consider those propositions, and in a very few words to express my own opinion that they must have a strong tendency to ease the minds of gentlemen who wish for the immediate operation of some essential parts of the proposed Constitution, as well as the most speedy and effectual means of obtaining alterations in some other parts of it, which they are solicitous should be made. I will not repeat the reasons I offered when the motion was made, which convinced me that the measure now under consideration will have a more speedy as well as a more certain influence in effecting the purpose last mentioned than the measure proposed in the Constitution before us. Your Excellency's first proposition is, quote, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated to Congress are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised, end quote.
Okay, so let me... Did he add the people? In other words, the 10th Amendment reserved to the states and the people respectively. In other words, they just wanted to make sure that the state governments had, you know, what had the sovereignty over all things not delegated. And I think Madison took it to, you know, to this, to a higher level, if that makes sense. So keep on going.
Sure.
Thank you.
This appears to my mind to be a summary of a Bill of Rights, which gentlemen are anxious to obtain. It removes a doubt which many have entertained respecting the matter, and gives assurance that if any law made by the federal government shall be extended beyond the power granted by the proposed Constitution and inconsistent with the Constitution of the state, it will be an error and adjudged by the courts of law to be void. It is consonant with the second article in the present Confederation that each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States and Congress assembled. I have long considered the watchfulness of the people over the conduct of their rulers the strongest guard against the encroachments of power, and I hope the people of this country will always be thus watchful. Another of Your Excellency's propositions is calculated to quiet the apprehensions of gentlemen lest Congress should exercise an unreasonable control over the state legislatures. with regard to the time, place, and manner of holding elections, which by the fourth section of the first article are to be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, subject to control of Congress. I have had my fears lest this control should infringe the freedom of elections, which ought ever to be held sacred. Gentlemen who have objected to this controlling power in Congress have expressed their wishes that it had been restricted to such states as may neglect or refuse that power vested in them and to be exercised by them if they please. Your Excellency proposes in substance the same restriction, which I should think cannot be met with their full approbation. The power to be given to Congress to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises has alarmed the minds of some gentlemen. They tell you, sir, that the exercise of the power of laying and collecting taxes might greatly distress the several states and render them incapable of raising monies for the payment of their respective state debts or for any purpose. They say the impost and excise may be made adequate to the public emergencies in the time of peace and ask why the laying of direct taxes may not be confined to a time of war. You are pleased to propose to us that it be a recommendation that Congress, that, quote, Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the monies arising from the impost and excise shall be sufficient for the public exigencies, end quote. The prospect of approaching war might necessarily create an expense beyond the productions of impost and excise. How then would the government have the necessary means of providing for the public defense? Must they not have recourse to other resources besides impost and excise? The people, while they watch for their own safety, must and will have a just confidence in a legislature of their own election. The approach of war is seldom, if ever, without observation. It is generally observed by the people at large, and I believe no legislature of a free country would venture a measure which should directly touch the purposes of the people under a mere pretense, or unless they could show to the people's satisfaction that there had been, in fact, a real public exigency to justify it. Where was this guy today? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so obviously, but it just turned the corner when Jefferson was president and the commerce ships were captured in Tripoli, and how Jefferson immediately dispatched the Navy and the Marine Corps, you know, to go basically, you know, engage and, you know, rescue these, you know, our commerce and the sailors on that ship. And so had we not had the Union, we would not have been able to respond. And where would we be? I mean, anyway, right. So
didn't Jefferson also grant letters of marque and reprisal during that time?
Yes. Because that way we were actually, you know, basically reciprocating with the Ottoman Empire by capturing their ships. Yep.
Right.
And so it was a response, but I think he actually had to wait for all of the news to come back to get Congress to actually allow that, because he may have done that, but Congress had to allow that because that was that's an enumerated power that Congress will have that.
And so, right, they didn't have high-speed internet back then.
Right, they didn't. Okay, and the last paragraph here.
Okay. Your Excellency's next proposition is to introduce the indictment of a grand jury before any person shall be tried for any crime by which he may incur infamous punishment or loss of life. And it is followed by another which recommends a trial by jury in civil actions between citizens of different states, if either party shall request it. These and several others which I have mentioned are so evidently beneficial as to need no comment of mine. And they are all, in every particular, of so general a nature and so equally interesting to every state that I cannot but persuade myself to think that they all would all readily join with us in the measure proposed by Your Excellency if we should now adopt it. Gentlemen may make additional propositions if they think fit. It is presumed that we shall exercise candor towards each other, and that whilst on the one hand, gentlemen will cheerfully agree to any proposition intended to promote a general union, which may not be inconsistent with their own mature judgment, others will avoid the making such as may be needless or tend to embarrass the minds of the people of this Commonwealth and our sister states, and thereby not only frustrate Your Excellency's wise intention, but endanger the loss of that degree of reputation, which I flatter myself this Commonwealth has justly sustained.
There you go. And so,
now, quick question.
Go ahead.
So was Massachusetts the first state to recommend?
No. As a matter of fact, so when I, when we went through the states, we actually discovered that, I forget which state it was, we'd have to go back and listen, and I should have made a note of it, but there was actually one state before Massachusetts that actually made recommendations, and so I'll pull up the state order, maybe it'll jog my memory which state that was, because...
Might it have been Pennsylvania?
It might have been Pennsylvania, or it might have been Connecticut. And so I'd have to actually go back. And what I'll do is before we meet again, because we're going into those amendments, I'll, you know, make a cursory check between, because the states that have already ratified were Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Georgia, and Connecticut. And so one of those five states, you know, provided recommended amendments so ratifying. And it may have been Pennsylvania because... You would think that the amendments would come from a state that had some reservations, and because Pennsylvania vigorously debated it because they weren't going to give it a slam dunk.
Right.
Okay. And so we got about a minute and a half left. And what is coming up is Mr. Nason, who follows Samuel Adams. And he makes this oration, and he ends his oration regarding the oath. And the focus on the oath of office. And so I will
here
leave.
We go. You say we got a minute left
and we don't have time to cover this. This will probably take about 2.5 minutes. So it's a chunk. But it's clear that there was truly a shift when John Hancock formally recommended that in addition to, or not to stipulate, but as a call upon the other states as they ratified that they would, attend to or request these very specific amendments. And this is where, because we've already seen some states already that made some recommendations. And we covered all of the states that didn't vigorously debate it. But we could see some of the language actually come out of some of these states. And I think you're right. I think it was Pennsylvania, just because the logic dictates that the state that would, not necessarily slam dunk it or rubber stamp the Constitution would move forward. So anyway, we got any other parting comments for the last second here?
No, I think we've got it. I'm looking for it. So we are going to cover the oath in the next
right? Yes, that is correct. So we're actually out of time, and we actually have the music stepping on us. So we're going to cover Mr. Nason and the oath when we come back on Tuesday. Hopefully you'll be able to join us. Folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.